This was midwinter, that when traditionally you have a holiday and a celebration to celebrate the shortest day of the year, and so we have a special meal. In fact, all of this was dried or tinned food, which the cook just dressed up and gave fancy names to, and we made this menu with the pictures of all of us. This was my first year. These were all the people there my first year, and the second year we did. That's all the people in the second year, and we did the same sort of thing, you know, a dinner.
Freze Romanov.
I don't know what that is.
It sounds.
Sounds
French Russian.
It's probably tinned strawberries with some sort of liqueur in it, I'd say. I don't know. That's Eric Twelves. That's him in our first year. He's a biologist. And then in the second year, he was our base commander. They chose one of the people to be the base commander, who was officially the man, you know, who carried the cannon. He was in our second year, and then he went to. He's the one who's doing the fish farming now. This was Bob Cook. He was our cook in my second year. He was a really nice bloke. He's a good cook, but he never minded what anyone thought of his food. You know, as long as I know I've done it well, then, because you know how people always complain. They always can complain about food, but he wouldn't mind. As long as he felt he'd done a good job, and Ian Raybatz, he was a biologist, and he was really keen on cordon bleu, really good cooking, and of course all our cooking was tinned, or most of it was tinned, so it certainly wasn't cordon bleu, and he was the one who tended to complain a bit about the food, and he was also very keen on going out in the boats. And one day he came out in the boats with us, and we were going to the north part of the island. And so he'd left a steak and kidney pudding on to boil, and he'd said to the man who was helping him, because we took it in turns. The cook cooked throughout the week, but every day he had each one of us took it in turns to be the person who helped him and did the washing up, did the cleaning, you know, that sort of thing. So he said to the man who was helping him, who was Ian, he said, "Oh, when lunchtime comes, would you take the steak and kidney pudding out and serve it up, you see?" So he said, "Fine," you see. And as we were coming back, old Bob Cook, he says to me, he said, "I wonder how they like the steak and kidney." See, and I thought, that's funny. He'd never before worried whether people liked it or his food or not. When I got back, we found out why. He'd stained all the pastry bright green. So when they took this pudding out of the tin, it was just bright green pastry, which, of course, this person was almost sick on the spot when he got it. See, and that's what that photograph's about, because when it was Bob Cook's birthday, we did a birthday cake for him, and we did, I didn't do it, Eric, he made all this. He made this model of the green pudding, because, you know, just that was just a part of the fun of the year.
Do we really have only tinned food?
When we were there, yes, it was. We had tinned food, and we had dried food. We had dried potatoes, dried egg, dried beans, things like that. But they weren't as nice as you get nowadays. We also caught a lot of fish. We used to eat a lot of fresh fish. That was really nice. In fact, we used to have a tank. We had at one end of the hut. You can't really see it, but in this end of the hut down there, that was laboratories, and we had an aquarium system with tanks of running seawater, and we'd pump the seawater up from here through the tanks and back down to the sea. And so any fish we caught that weren't needed for experiments, we'd put in these tanks, and then if you were hungry, you could go and knock one on the head and clean it and fry it and have fresh fish. So we had a lot of fresh fish, and penguins. We used to eat penguins as well. That's very nice meat. The breast meat is very dark. It's the texture of steak. Texture of steak really. But it's the colour of almost like liver. Very dark red meat because it's a diving animal. I think it has different hemoglobins, and I think that's what makes it look very dark. We used to eat that, and we used to eat seal sometimes if we killed a seal. But we didn't rarely have to kill a seal, so. We didn't have that very often. And we tried most of the other birds that were around. We would, you know, just to vary the diet. And we used to, somewhere here I have a picture. Where is it? We used to get penguins' eggs as well. I think they've stopped doing that now. There we are. See, these are boxes of penguins' eggs. Here we used to collect them in the early part of the season, and then we would store them. That's boxes and boxes of them. We used to take about 1,500 eggs, and then we would store them in a cold place, and they would last for several months. And they're about. I've got some here which I blew. That's the sort of size they are. That's a pygocoelid penguin. Penguins here, pygocoelid penguins. They're about 18 inches tall, and they lay eggs about that size. When you're cooking, that's equivalent to about two chickens' eggs, you know, about the size of two chickens' eggs. Mm-hmm. But we used to collect them. I think they've stopped doing that now. I think because of international agreements, they're a lot more careful, and they don't even, on our island, they wouldn't now take penguins' eggs, I think. But we thought that there were so many, I mean, the penguin rookeries have millions of birds in them, and we thought, oh, it'll be okay to take those, but I think they're more strict and more careful now about things. There's how in a penguin rookery, you can see how close they nest. This is an albino penguin, but there's one nest, you see, there's another one. They're very close together, and I did some counts, and in a 10 meter square you get 80 nests in a 10-metre square. So they're often just out of pecking distance. So you'd have one penguin here, and he's just out of pecking distance of the next nest, you know. So, and that they could be really, really tight together there. That's Bob Cook, and he's holding one of these penguins.
Aww.
That's an Adélie penguin. These are chin straps. There, that's, as I say, that was a... an albino one. This is them displaying to each other. They make a lovely noise. You know, you can hear a penguin rookery from miles away, and you can smell it from miles away. You know, if the wind's in the right direction, you can smell a very acrid sort of guano smell, and and you hear the noise, you know, sort of mutter, mutter, mutter noise. And when you're actually in the rookery and you cause a disturbance, they're sort of squawking away a lot. You know, it's really quite noisy. But...
That's the first time I hear anybody talk about smells.
Oh,
South Pole.
Yeah, really. Well, if the wind's in the right direction, as you walk nearer the penguin rookery, really does, you know, really does smell. And these birds. Where's another one? Blue-eyed shags. Sorry, I should be better organised. That's a blue-eyed shag, and it's a pity it's not in colour. It has a beautiful blue eye and a gold crest there, and this is its nest. And they every year they come back to the same nest, and they have this is just really penguin shit and feathers and things all mixed, and it gets higher and higher. But they nest in, say, on our island, they nested on one main rock, and lots of them. And when we went once a year to put rings on their legs, they would you'd end up after a morning putting rings on, you'd absolutely have a bad headache because of the ammonia. You know, it just reeks of ammonia coming from their droppings. You know, it's very, very very, very rich. And it was interesting too, on Deception, I went to Deception Island before I got to my own island. We went to the South Shetlands, and there'd been a volcanic eruption on one of the islands, Deception Island, and there was a party to go there to map and investigate the eruption from the previous year. Okay, well, now also there was a flat bit of land there, and they used Deception Island those days as a staging post for the aircraft, and they had small twin otter aircraft. And while they were there, we got a chance of a jolly, you know, a little flight in one of these. And it was very interesting to go around the island in this, because from the air you could see the rookery as a sort of white or pinky area on the rocks because of the droppings of the birds, you know. But these were we ringed these chicks, and then I remember Eric here, he was mad keen huntsman, sportsman, and we'd only ringed these, and a few days later he was out on the ice and he saw some of these birds flying over and he shot them, and we got our first recovery literally just a few days after we'd actually put the ring on. He went and shot one of these things, you know, so he was sort of not too popular. This is Percy, he was a botanist, and he's cutting an ice snow block because in winter no running water, so the exhausts from the diesel generators went underneath a tank, and every day we filled up the tank with snow, and then the heat from the generators melted the snow, and we got our water that way. And we used to take it in turns to do to be what we called gash hand. That was just the slang name, gash hand, which, and that meant when you were, it was your day, you did all the cleaning, you did all the washing up, you did you cleaned the toilets out, you filled up the tank with snow. That was your job for the day, and we took it in turns, and everyone everyone did it. Not just on the British bases, there wasn't a hierarchy, there weren't like the scientists and then the servants, it wasn't like that. Everyone shared everything, you know, all the jobs. And that was different to say, if you went, I visited an Argentinian base, and there it was a military base, so the officers did no work and the enlisted men did all the work. Mm-hmm. But the British didn't work that way, and I think it's very important. That was very important because you didn't, it was one less source of irritation. You know, it's difficult enough to get on with just a small group of people in one little hut, and the fewer sources of irritation, the better. And if you know everyone's doing the same work and everyone's going to have their turn, then you feel a lot, you know, I think it causes less trouble that way.
But you were an assistant.
I was, yes, I was called a general assistant. I was assisting, like, he was a biologist, microbiologist. He was a meteorologist. He, although he was a film man, he couldn't come down just as a film man. He came down as a meteorologist, and he filmed in his spare time. He was a botanist. He was our wireless operator. He was our cook. He was a botanist. He was our diver. He was our diesel mechanic, that's Dave Rinning. He was a biologist. He was a meteorologist, and he was a biologist. So we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 scientists. Mm-hmm. We had 3 meteorologists, and then, so that's 8, and then there were 5 support personnel, the diver, the cook, the radio operator, the diesel mechanic, and myself. We were the support personnel, people to help keep the scientists going. But in my second year, they did away with the meteorologist program. They stopped that, and because on the first year, what they were doing, every 3 hours, they would radio the information back to Falkland Islands. But they decided for the next year, for a reason, I don't know quite why, but they decided not to, to stop that program. So we went down to 10 people for my second year, you know, and that was 5 scientists, 5 support personnel. And the scientists worked harder than I've known any scientists in this country work. They worked very, very hard. And I think they had a limited time to do their research, and they knew once they came back home to England they couldn't repeat any experiments, so they did all their research, and then they came back to England and they spent maybe 2 years or 3 years writing it up to get their PhDs and things. Mm-hmm. But I think they worked really, really hard. What else? That was the cook in our first year. That's me. I'm helping. It's my turn to be on gash, but this is a special occasion. This must have been a party, because we didn't normally wear hats, or, you know. And on Sundays, the cook would have a day off, and we would then each take it in turns to cook on Sunday. So we would, so that he could have a day off, we would take it in turns and do the cooking on Sunday, which was good fun. what else to show you? That's dotted around the island were little huts. That was by a penguin rookery, and it was made out of really old packing cases, and it was stropped down to stop it blowing away. And you could, it had just room for one, no, two bunks, I think that one had. So you could, I was helping one of the scientists with a project on penguins. So I'd go over there, spend the night, get up early in the morning, do my records, then come back to the base. But it used to be good fun to go there all on your own, you know. And there's another, we had another one somewhere. Can't see it just now, but we had another hut much the same we went to. Oh, there, that's it, there in the background there. And this one, we went diving from there. This was the other side of the island from our main base, and no one had dived there, so we went to just to see, do a bit of exploring in the water, and that we lived in this hut and we dived from it. It was good fun.
When did you learn to dive?
Before I went to the Antarctic, it had been one of my hobbies at college, was diving. Not to a high level, not to a particularly skilled level, but enough so that I was able to, you know, do the diving here, which was really good fun. It really was. The water gets very, very clear in winter when the sea freezes. That cuts the light level down so much that none of the plankton can grow. The little phytoplankton can't grow. So, and also because the ice is on the surface, that damps down all the waves. So the sea isn't being churned up. So that means everything gets beautifully clear, you know, and you get 7,500 foot visibility, something like that, underneath the ice. Beautiful clear. I haven't got any photographs really of that, but I've seen some. I saw some on television about 6 months ago. There's someone who'd been down to Sydney Island just recently. He took some video underneath. It was absolutely fantastic. You know, it really was good. This is Deception Island, and you see there's a wrecked ship, old whale catcher. And what it is with Deception is, I've got a map here. That's Deception Island, you see. And it's from the outside, it looks like one big mountain, maybe, I don't know, 20 miles across. But in fact, there's a little entrance here, and then you've got this huge harbour here. And when the year before we went there, there'd been an eruption across here, and a new island had formed there. And the Chilean base, that there was Chileans lived there, that got buried in ash. So we went to look at that, but this wreck here is right at the entrance. It's just down there. And what happened was, seemingly in the 1950s, that ship was coming out, and it met a big factory ship coming in, and it tried to get out of the way and didn't, and got wrecked there. But that was good. I'll show you what else I got. That's where the South Orkneys are. So it's not really actually in the Antarctic. It's still only just 60 degrees. Mm-hmm. But because it's so near such a big continent, the sea freezes just a bit north of us. So, you know, we call it the Antarctic. Is that the Antarctic Convergence? Or is that the Antarctic Convergence? Yes, yeah, so it gets cold beyond that. And South Shetlands, that's where Deception Island was. That's South Georgia, where your boss was up there.
Deception Island has disappeared.
No, it's still there. Still there, yes. And it's, I don't think there's a base on it any longer. I don't think they land aircraft on it any longer. Because we went there about Christmas time, and we, to investigate what had happened, I was an assistant to a volcanologists who were experts in volcanoes. We were just there to assist them carry things. And we left there about January, February time. And then maybe 1 month later, there was another eruption, an even worse eruption. And they went back and did a new survey of that the following year. But I think after that, they stopped living on that island because it was just too unpredictable. You know, and every time there was an eruption, they had to be rescued. You know, they had to send ships or helicopters in to rescue them. You know, so no one was hurt. But this is This is Cygni Island. This is the island I lived on. It was in the South Orkneys. This is Coronation Island to the north, and then Cygni Island, and our base was just there. This was about maybe 5 miles long by about, say, 3 miles across there. Mm-hmm. And there's another main island that's on here, the South Orkneys, called Powell Island. It's not on this map. I might show you. There it is. It's there, that one there. Powell Island, that's right, and then Laurie Island, that's the one the Argentinians have a base on. We went to visit them in a boat. In fact, we got into trouble because the powers that be reckoned that it was too dangerous, but we still think we took precautions enough for that.
What did you go doing there, visiting?
Yeah, just to visit them, really. Yeah, we
how do you do?
That's right.
How's work going?
Yeah, yeah. And I think we just wanted to do something, really, you know. And, sometimes people would have holidays, and for a holiday they would cross over to this island. And they would climb the mountains, you know, if they were interested in mountain climbing. Mm. I wouldn't. I wasn't good at mountain climbing, but I liked the thought of trying to see, you know, travel further along and just see further along these islands.
But officially, of course, the contact between the British and the Argentines is quite cold.
It was, yes.
Also at the time, so probably the superiors in England wouldn't have recommended it.
I think if we'd asked them, they wouldn't have known. From political reasons as well, you know, as you say. Mm. And in fact, I think it was a bit of an embarrassment because it got in the Argentinian newspapers that we'd visited there. And it was all what happened was we'd recce'd it. In the winter we'd put where'd we put it? We'd put a schist point. We'd put a depot of emergency food in the winter when all the sea was frozen. We trekked a big depot of food, a packing case about 3 foot cube with food and fuel, so we put that on there. And then in the summer, the next summer, we went and visited this area. We came along the coast when it was good weather, and we got as far as here, the divide, which there's actually a little gap through there, and we got that far. And then we thought, well, to get from there to here is possible given good weather, so we just waited till we got good weather, and we prepared the boat. And it was the diesel mechanic and myself who we wanted to do this, because I used the boat a lot with my job anyway. And we decked it in, and we put a good covering, we got it loaded up, and then we just waited for good weather. And we were in contact with the Argentinians on the radio anyway. We used to have quite good communication with them on a local level, their base, and they were very good at predicting the weather, really good, you know. So we asked them, and eventually they said, oh yes, good weather for several days, I think it was. So we said to our base commander, because there was room for three in the boat, we said, do you want to come with us, you see? And he said, oh no, he says, I've got to come up on a radio sked with headquarters, they're specifically asking to speak to me, you see. So we left about 3 a.m, because that was when the weather was good. We wanted to make use of it and went. And seemingly what headquarters wanted to speak to him about, they said, look, there have been too many trips off your island, people going for holidays and climbing mountains, and it's dangerous, and there's going to be an accident, and then it's going to be real trouble, you see. So he then had to say to them, well, actually, I'm very sorry, but there's another party just left this morning going off there, and they almost had kittens, I think. And the trouble was, we got to the Argentinian island. What we meant really to do was just hand over our presents, say hello, turn around, come back. But we were much more tired than we thought we were going to be. So they said, oh, stay, we've got a birthday party tonight, and go tomorrow morning, you see. So we said, right, we'll stay for their birthday. One of their people had a birthday party, and we thought we'll go next morning. But by next morning, the weather had changed. So we were stuck there for a week or so then. And they were very hospitable. And while we were there, we one of the things we were able to do, which was really good fun, we were able to go around the north of the island to a place called Cape Geddes, which is about halfway along this island here. And that was where the first British base on the South Orkneys was put down, operation at the end of Operation Tabarin. The first one of the first FIDS bases was put there in 1946, and it had only been used, I think, for 1 year because the landing conditions were too rough. You know, although it looked quite nice, it was only on a very calm day that they could easily land. So after one, I think it was 1 year or 2 years, they said, no, we'll move. And they moved to Sydney Island. But we were able to go and visit that hut. And it was really good to go there, because, in fact, it was in a bit of a mess. The Argentinians had not kept it clean and tidy, it would have been good if they had done, because it was a good refuge if people got shipwrecked or something like that. But there were still old tins of flour, old tins of food, you know, in the hut. And that was 25 years previously, you know. And what's interesting is we took some of the Argentinians in our boat to visit it, because they'd never been there. And they obviously heard us talking, saying this is a bit of a mess. And when I visited it again about a year later, I was doing a seal survey with my boss. My boss was doing a seal survey and I was accompanying him, just counting fur seals. And when we got there again, it had all been repaired, all been tidied, all the doors closed, you know, everything. So the Argentinians had, you know, made it look really good. I did have a photograph of it, but I can't find that now. But it's really funny. When we actually motored up near the Argentinian base, it took us about 8 hours, I think it was, to get there. And their base was at the end of a long fjord, like a fjord. And you turn the corner and you start motoring in. And several miles, you see, we could see in the distance these tiny little huts. And then you could see a little man walking up and down and up and down, you see. And then all of a sudden he spotted us, you know. And we hadn't told them we were coming, because we thought we won't say anything until we actually arrive. And the excitement when we arrived, you know, it was really, you could see him looking, you know. And he obviously, there would have been no ships or anything for months and months. And then for him to look out and see somebody coming must have been really quite a shock to him. And what else can I show you? Those are the Weddell seals. That's a mother and a pup. That's a mother feeding a pup. And when the baby's born, the mother is really, really fat, you know, really big and fat. And the pup is born, I think about 30 pounds, weighs about 30 pounds when it's born, and it puts on weight at maybe 30 to 50 pounds a week. You know, it really grows fast at the expense of the mother. And by 8 weeks, 6-8 weeks, when the pup is weaned, the mother is all skin and bone. You know, you can see her pelvic girdle, whereas she's really fat there, but she's lost all her blubber then in feeding the pup. And one of my jobs was to put tags on the seal flippers, little like cattle ear tags with a number on them. And then in future years, if you saw a seal with a tag on it, you could go and try and read the number, and you could then work out when they became mature, when they had pups of their own, did they come back to the same places, this sort of thing. And the pups that were small enough, you could put the tag in without worrying, as long as the mother wasn't too close. But the mothers used to get very agitated, you know, you came up to their pups.
And
well, they didn't most of the time. They used to come up snapping like that, like that. But I used to think that they would stop just before they got to you, you know. And so I used to rely on this. And when I was teaching somebody who was going to do the seal tagging the following year, when I went home, I said to him, oh, they won't bite, no problem, you see. And I said, you just stand still and they'll come up to you like that and then they'll stop. In fact, I did a silly thing. I turned my back on one mother and that she didn't stop, and she bit me in the bottom, and she fortunately she didn't break my skin. She just got hold of my trousers, and then she shook me like this, and she shook me right off my feet. And I was going back, as I was being shaken around, I could see this other bloke looking at me, and he hadn't really wanted to do this anyway, and he was looking at me as if to say, well, I'm certainly not doing this now. And when she put me down, when the mother put me down, she'd bitten through my windproof trousers, through my ordinary trousers, through my underpants, and I'd had a metal comb in my pocket, and she'd crunched all that up. But fortunately, she hadn't actually bitten me, you know. So, but what used to be sad was they weren't so much threatening as they were just anxious. They were agitated. They didn't know what to do. And sometimes, if you came, some mothers were so agitated that they would pick up their pup and shake their pup. And I remember seeing a mother kill its pup doing that. You know, it didn't really. I don't know what the technical term for it is, but it was so agitated it didn't know what to do, and it just did something silly like that. Yeah. We tried to weigh these pups, and that was the Diesel mechanic and I, Adrian Gilmore. He designed sort of a beam balance that fitted on the back of a skidoo. Our skidoos in those days were really old ones. I haven't got a picture of one, don't think. No, I haven't got a picture here, but he engineered a sort of balance, and what we used to do was wrestle the seal into a post office sack, one of the sacks that our letters had come in, and then haul it up on this balance to try and weigh it. And what we had to do is one of us had to keep the mother away while you did that. But as I say, they put on weight very, very fast. So they start about 30 pound, and by the time they're weaned, they're sort of between 200 and 300 pounds, you know, so they put on an awful lot of weight. And we weighed one. We got one that was a year old. We knew it was a year old because it had last year's tag on it. And that had actually lost weight between being weaned and us weighing a year old. It seemed lighter than the ones that were just weaned. I mean, I don't know if it actually had lost weight, but it seemed less. It was less than the average for the ones that were just being weaned.
But you were there when the seal started killing its own
pick.
Kid.
Yeah, it picked
out
it
out of anxiety.
Yes, it picked it up by the neck and just shook it, and it broke its neck. I think that's what must have happened.
Did you feel bad about it?
Well, yes, because you know, wouldn't have done it if. We'd known not all mothers were like that, but you know, this particular one was. The other thing you could do, if a seal charged you, what used to with your glove, I used to hit it on the nose. If you hit it on the nose, and you'd see it screw its eyes up like that, and it would go back like that, it almost as if you'd half stunned it, and then it would that seemed a good way of. But I was talking to Mr. Laws, or Dr. Laws, who was he ended up as head of British Antarctic Survey, but he'd been on South Georgia and Sydney Island right at the beginning as a young man, and his subject, he'd investigated elephant seals, among other things. But and he told me that was one way to kill seals, was to hit them hard on the nose, you know, with a pickaxe handle, you know, sweep, and that would kill seals. So maybe me hitting it with a glove, that was not a nice thing to do to a seal, probably. So we got to show you skuas. They were nice birds. They skua gull. You get them very similar ones. I think were almost the same up in the north. And they used to. They were scavengers, and they would live off the penguin rookeries, getting unattended eggs or chicks that escaped. Because the penguin chicks would group together in creches, great groups together, but if anyone got separated, then they'd be harried and pecked to death by them. Very good flyers, and they would nest in the moss and among the rocks, and if you're walking anywhere near their nests, you'd be trudging along, you know, coming back to the base, and you're all tired, and if you didn't notice, if you were anywhere near their nest, they'd scare you off. They'd come down and bang you on the head, you know, bang with their feet or their wings, and they'd come from behind and bang like that, and you'd wake you up. Yeah, and you'd be all annoyed. But we had one pair that nested only a few yards away from our base hut, and they reared chicks there, and they used to come and feed off the kitchen roof, and you know, they to begin with, when you'd open through the kitchen window, if you held food out in your hand, they'd snatch, and it would they really got sharp beaks, and that would hurt. But after a while, they learnt to take the food very gently and carefully, so they didn't hurt you, you know. Hello, you. Come in for a seat. Is there anything else I should be?
Well, you should tell me about your first impression, because you told me about the filmer who had his first impression, but what was it? Do you remember the first day that you were there?
First day?
Yeah.
All I remember about it was arriving, and I got off with all my luggage and going onto the base, and it was almost empty because all the other people had gone on board the ship to see their friends or scrounge some food or something like that. So I don't remember really much else, except the man who was left behind was the diesel mechanic called Roger, and he found me a bunk room, you know, to sleep in, and that. I don't really remember much more than that. No, I don't, on my first day. What was interesting, I got on all right with Roger, but he was only there for a few months, and then he left to go back home. And I then discovered that he and another of the men had been at daggers drawn. You know, they had not got on well at all. And yet it was a sign to me that how you, for the sake of the common good, people suppressed all that, that I hadn't picked up this animosity at all. Not really. I'd guessed that they weren't bosom pals, but I hadn't guessed how the one got the other really annoyed until one of them left and the other was so pleased to see him go. You know, it was I found that quite interesting. He, the diesel mechanic, he was on loan from the RAF, and he was a bit older than the rest of them, and he was quite a serious person. You know, he wasn't flippant, and the man he didn't get on with was a meteorologist, but he'd been a medical student, and he'd failed that. And he was a good talker. He loved to talk, and he liked to drink as well. And he would love an argument, you know. So they were just two poles apart. They were two completely different sort of personalities, you know. And they didn't get on. But I can't honestly remember my first day there. I can remember my first day leaving on the ship from Southampton, because, you know, you wonder if you've done the right thing, you know. And I can remember that. Do you want tea?
Or
coffee? Or
later on.
Right.
You had about 10 days sailing to wonder if you did the right thing.
Sorry?
You had about 10 days of sailing to think about whether you wondering.
Oh, it was more. It was about 3 weeks. I went down on the Biscoe, and John Biscoe, and she was slow ship, did about 10 knots. And it was about 3 weeks to Montevideo. And then the ship broke down, and then we stayed in Montevideo for several weeks, and then we went to Falkland Islands. But I think I remember it was always good when the ship actually sailed, you thought, right, fine, it's happened now, you know. But it's when you're just waiting for things to happen that you wonder, you know, if you've done the right thing or not. I never really thought I hadn't, you know. I knew I was going to enjoy it. I just sort of didn't, and everything that people had told me about it, like before I actually went down south, I did some training in the laboratories to learn techniques, and they were often with people who'd been in the Antarctic, so they'd do like I'm doing here, you know. I hardly did any learning of new techniques, but they'd be bringing out slides and photographs and talking, telling you what it's like. And so everything I heard made me think, oh, I'm going to enjoy this. And I did too. It was a very enjoyable time for me.
That's what you told me about, is that you said on the phone that it's like, I want all of this and not just this part and this part, and you could leave out this.
That's right.
That's right.
Yes, I made the mistake once of saying to one of my wife's friends, I said, oh, these were the best years of my life, you see. And then she told that to Alison. She's not let me forget it. But it wasn't the best years of my life. But they were the most carefree, you know, because I'd just finished college. I'd read zoology as a degree. I hadn't got a good degree, so I couldn't, not good enough to go as a scientist to do research, but good enough for me to go. They were kind enough to take me as an assistant. So I'd finished college, finished exams. First time I'd had some money because of a job, travelling, you know. It was very carefree, very, very nice time. But what's interesting is that I've had twice since then, in recent years, I've had a dream where I've dreamt that I'm on the island, I've just got off the ship, and the ship's spending the night, and then the next day it's going to sail away, okay, and go back, and then it won't come back for another year. And in both these dreams, I've been very relieved to wake up and find that I'm not down there. It's funny, I don't, because I remember also when the ship came and dropped you off, okay, that's fine, you get settled in. And then the ship, towards the end of the summer, it may pay a last visit to drop some mail off or to pick up all the people who are going home. And on our island, one time at any rate, it used to spend the night there, offload fuel into the big tanks, fuel tanks. So it would be there all night, and then next morning it would sail off. And it was a relief when it had gone, because then there was no possibility. You couldn't say, oh, I changed my mind, I want to go home. You know, you knew you were there. But as I say, I found it interesting that in my dreams, I was relieved that I hadn't, even though I know I'd have enjoyed it, I'm relieved that I hadn't in my dream, you know, stayed on down there. Does that make sense? Yeah, do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
No. So there are, I mean, you lose out on things. There's no family life down there. There's no, there are good things, but it's not something I would like to do all my life. You know, like some people seem to make a career of going down there year after year. I wouldn't have liked to do that. I'm very glad to have done it, and I'd love to go back again, but I wouldn't like to have that as all my life, you know, down there.
Did you ever thought about staying on when you were there?
Yeah. I only signed on for 1 year originally, and then when I was down there, they asked me if I'd like to spend another year. So I said yes. I spent 2 years, 2 winters down there. And then when I came home, they offered me a job on the permanent staff as a technician helping scientists. And I'd have been based in near Cambridge. And the idea was that I would help scientists prepare their equipment and experiments to go down south. But also, every so often, I would go down south to do experiments for senior scientists who couldn't spare the time to go down there. So, in fact, I worked for them for about 18 months in that capacity. So if I'd wanted to, I could have, assuming all had gone well, I could have stayed on as a permanent job there. But I then ended up thinking what I really wanted to do. And there were little pointers, like even though I was the same age as some of the young scientists who were starting, they would say, oh, I'm going to do this, that and the other. And I'd say, oh, won't work, you know. And I found myself getting maybe a bit short with them, and they're my own age. Now I thought to myself, what am I going to be like 10 years' time? You know, I'm not going to be a nice person to live with, you know, for that. And also the thought of, it would be very nice to go back down there for 6 months every few years, but that would really disrupt any family life. At least it seemed to me it would. So I thought, and I decided to change careers then. And I applied and went back to college to train to be a dentist, and that's what I've been doing ever since. And I mean, I enjoy that very much too. You know, I wouldn't want to go back to what I've done, even though I enjoyed the Antarctic very much. I'm trying to think, what do you think? Is there anything I've said in particular that you think struck you about me in the Antarctic?
I think it was lots and lots of opportunities to do different things. I was saying to you, I don't know your name.
Yeah.
Yap.
Yeah.
That you know, like you were saying about equipment, it gave you
opportunity, yes,
to be self sufficient and not to be frightened of attempting to do different things.
Mm. Yes, it gave you a lot of self confidence, I think, because I'm not a particularly handy person. I haven't got particular skills in any direction, but something breaks down, you can't say, oh, I'll get an expert in to repair it, because there isn't an expert, you know. So you have to repair it yourself, or with the assistance of, say, the diesel mechanic, who's a good engineer. And you have to sort of think to yourself, well, a man made this bit of machinery, so another man can take it apart and maybe get it going again. You know, okay, you didn't always, but it gave you a lot of self-confidence about attempting things.
Where did this start?
Hmm?
Where did it start?
What, the self-confidence?
No. When did you, for the first time, did you have this piece of machinery or technique in hands where you think, yeah?
I don't know about the first one, but I can think of one. That was a seawater pump. It was a pump that we pumped water from the seabed up into the tanks and back down again. That was one of my responsibilities. And that was always breaking down, always going wrong, because the rubber, it was like an Archimedean screw, really, that went through a rubber sleeve, so it could pump up things, and it was always seemed to be breaking down. So that was one thing I can remember having to take apart and then put together again. And I learnt all about outboard engines, you know, two-stroke engines, because I had a lot to do with either the outboards that powered the our small boats, or we had two-stroke engine that powered a chainsaw if we were cutting holes in the sea ice used. So I learnt a lot about engines, which, you know, not much, but enough to get by. You know, I think those are two things. What else? I think another thing that one learnt was it was good to work hard. You know, everyone there, that you never seemed to have anyone who was lazy. You know, people did their jobs, because small group, if you don't do your job, then you're a real annoyance to everyone else. So that idea of working reliably and hard, I think that it reinforced that.
But you just told me, what struck me was that you told me that the irritation keeps under the
mm-hmm.
level of somewhere down below,
mm.
like the two persons which you talk about, which mm. are effects were fighting out a quarrel which you didn't know
mm-hmm.
even know about
mm.
after 2 months.
Mm.
Is that the usual way of dealing with opposite characters in conflict?
I don't know. Maybe I'm particularly insensitive to things, but certainly the 2 years I was there, I found the people very easy to get on with. You know, I had, from my side of things, I didn't have any trouble. I mean, maybe they thought I was awful and they had to make allowances for me, so maybe I was very insensitive. But we were fortunate. Most of the time I was there, we didn't have any trouble at all. But one of those books I was telling you about, that Roger Banks book, he deals quite a lot with the irritations, you know, that can develop.
I think that there was, I mean, Eric Twelves rang him up. I mean, he hasn't been in touch with Owen for years and years, has
mm.
he? And one of your group had died prematurely.
Birthday, you know, every birthday would be really well celebrated. And you have a special meal, you all dress up in your suit, and the chef would put on a special meal and things like that. And every Saturday, we used to, in the morning, we would scrub out the whole base, clean the whole base, and everyone would have a job to do. And all the jobs were broken down into however many people there were, 13 people, 13 jobs. And then the next week, you'd do a different job, and the next week, a different job, and you gradually go through all the jobs. So you'd spend all Saturday morning cleaning the base. And then on Saturday evening, we used to have a special meal, and because we'd, from our own money, we'd bought frozen meat from Uruguay, beef, steak, and we got lamb or mutton from the Falkland Islands. So that we bought that with our own money. And then on Saturdays, we'd have frozen meat as a special meal, and we get dressed, dress up, put on your suit, something like that. And then we would also had our base issue of booze.
Did they notice at the British Antarctic Survey that you bought your own food?
Oh, yes, yes. We used to buy our own drink as well. We had a certain issue. When I was there, you got, for the whole base, you'd get 1 pint of rum and 1 bottle of spirits for a week, plus 1 can of beer per man. That's what the British Antarctic Survey supplied. But we could buy in our own supplies of beer or other drink, and we could buy in our own luxuries and our own, and they would come on the ships. They'd come in at the beginning of the summer. You know, obviously you couldn't get them all the year round, but just when the ships came in. So we used to do that. And on Saturday, in our base, we had the tradition of bringing out the base issue of booze on Saturday night. So after the meal, we would have a party or sit and drink and talk or play bridge or something like that. And the rum was Navy rum. It was before this. They don't give it now in the British Navy, but it used to come in big stone jars like that, and it was very, very strong, and that you used to have to dilute it with water. At least the Navy used to dilute it with water, but we would be given a pint. I think it was a pint of this per week, and it was very, very nice, you know, very nice rum. And the first year I was there, people used to drink till all the booze was finished, and someone would bring out his own case of beer, and you know, and so a lot of people just kept drinking on Saturday night. So Sunday, most of them would sleep in really late, you know, and that wasn't the way I like to do things, because I liked, if I could, to take Sunday as a day off. I mean, obviously I couldn't insist on it. If the whole week had been very bad weather with gales and storms and the scientists hadn't been able to go out and do their diving, if Sunday was a clear day, a nice sunny day, I couldn't say, oh no, I'm having a day off. Obviously we went and did our work then, but if I could, I took Sunday off, partly for religious reasons, because Sunday is a special day to a Christian, but also because it was not much happened on Sunday. Otherwise people were sleeping off. A lot of them, people were sleeping off all the drink they'd had the night before. Not everybody did this, but a lot of them drank. Now, in the second year I was there, people didn't drink nearly so much like that. They would drink until they'd had enough and then stop. And often there would be booze left over throughout the week, and it would be up on the shelf and you could go and help yourself to it. And so in the first year, people didn't do very much on Sundays. But the second year, people were a lot more alert and active on Sundays. And there was a lot more travelling done, you know, around the island and on the ice. And I used to take Sunday off, and I'd go up in the hills, or if it was in the summer, I'd take a boat out and I'd motor off to a more inaccessible part of the island just to see what I could see. You know, it was really good.
This was Sunday celebrated on the base?
By nothing really at all. It just the fact that people lay in more. It was the cook's day off, so you always had an amateur cook cooking for Sundays. And otherwise people just did what they wanted. There was nothing special on Sunday. There were no religious services or anything like that. And
was there a sense of equality? I mean, did you all feel equal to each other? Or did you...
Yeah, I did.
There wasn't a sense of somebody was a leader or somebody was...
There was a base commander, but he was appointed by London. And so... he wasn't paid anymore. He wasn't paid anything for doing that. And there was such a tradition that everything came down to routine, you know, so he didn't have a lot of decisions to make, like now we will do this or now we will do that. You know, he was there more if things went wrong and to or if foreign people were involved, you know,
visitors
and things like that. But the British had a good idea in that, say, in my first year... Where's that picture? Right. So when I first went down there, he'd already spent a winter. He'd spent a winter. I was new. He was new. He was new. They were new. No, he'd spent a winter. He'd spent a winter. He was new. He'd spent a winter. And he was new. So half of them had been there for a whole winter. So they knew what they knew, the geography, they knew what was safe, what was dangerous to do. Okay, then at the end of that year they all left, and then some more people came, but then by then we were the old half who had lived there for a year, so we knew what was safe. And, you know, when is the sea, for example, when the sea begins to freeze, or when is it safe to walk on that, you know, and what areas are always dangerous, what areas on the glaciers have got crevasses, all this sort of thing. Because you've got half the people there who knew what was going on, they quickly passed on the knowledge to the new people, whereas some countries, they will change a whole base every year. So they'll have a team of men who'll get together, train together in, say, Australia or New Zealand. I think they do it this way. And then they would, all of them as a lump, go down and replace absolutely everybody. But of course, you've got people there with no experience then, you know, so they're cautious. And they're
it's a discontinuity.
Yes. But I think they wouldn't, the Antarctic Survey wouldn't allow you to spend more than two winters down there without coming home. You couldn't, I don't think I could have signed on for another winter or another, you know, I think they'd have wanted you to come home. And then if you wanted to go down again, then you reapply. I think that's what the rule they had.
And what about Christmas?
Oh, that was good fun, yes. We'd, one Christmas I was on Deception Island, and then I was two Christmases on Cygni Island. It was a bit like midwinter, a big meal. Chef makes a special meal, and people make presents, you know. We weren't really into that. Nowadays, I think they make a great effort to make really nice presents for each other, and everyone makes one present, put it in a raffle, and then you draw lots and whatever you get. We didn't do anything like that, but I think that's a nice tradition that has started. But in Christmas is the summer, so you often have a lot of visitors. You know, summer visitors, who scientists who come down just for the summer, or a lot of the carpenters, the chippies, they used to come down to do the building because that could only be done in the summer, a lot of it. So you'd often have a lot of people on the base who weren't
regular
people. Midwinter was more like a little family, you know, and we would have two or three days of celebrations.
Did people, I mean, what kind of things did they talk about? I mean, because you couldn't talk about sport, could you? You couldn't talk about who played such and such a match. And did you talk about girls, or did you talk about your work? Or
I'm trying to think. There was that people talked about. Sometimes they'd talk about girls, because I remember this one. He was awful. He's an awful fella in a way, but he's quite funny. And he'd say, oh, his big thing when he got really into his cups and got onto the subject of women, he'd say, oh, I wouldn't like a daughter of mine to meet someone like me, he'd say. But otherwise, what do people talk about? They would discuss sport, they would do, you know, favourite football teams, this sort of thing. Or sometimes you'd get an argument start up over something totally unimportant, but almost for the sake of arguing. Like, I remember I had an argument with, where is he, Feenan, this one here, this radio operator. He was an Irishman, he loved an argument as well. And I don't know if you remember it, you probably don't, but in Life, the American magazine, there was a famous photograph of a baboon being attacked by a leopard, I think it was, or some large cat. And this poor baboon was, the photograph was a brilliant photograph, taken just as the animal attacked it. And we were going on about how good, because we discussed photography a lot, everyone took lots of photographs, so that was one big topic of conversation. But we were saying what a good photograph it was, and then someone said, oh, well, you know how they did that? And he said he'd heard that they'd put the baboon and the animal in a small enclosure, so the poor baboon had no chance of escaping. And so I took the argument that this was totally immoral and was not true to life, and it was that devalued the photograph to me. But Tony Feenan took the opposite side, that it was a perfectly valid photograph, and it was just a way of making sure you could get your photograph. And we argued about this, totally pointless, but we argued, not getting that cross, but just keep arguing. And I remember a man coming in saying, "What's all this?" And another one just said to him, "Oh, it's just two fids arguing. It's a fid argument," which was the way people just said, "Oh, it's, you know, just what happens when you get two people, you know, talking about something that's unimportant." What else did we talk about?
Was it unimportant to you at the moment?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't really important. It was, but it was just something that you get hot under the collar about. Yes, but it wasn't really that important. What else did we? I remember one bloke coming. He was new on the base, and he came in when we were having coffee, one coffee time, and he said, "Oh," he said, "this is like a doctor's waiting room, because we were all just sitting there reading magazines and we weren't talking much at all. So maybe after a while, maybe you ran out of conversation a bit." But
did somebody send you letters, or girls wrote to you?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, with this one here, John Edwards. His sister worked in a factory in Liverpool, and he took lots of photographs of people on the base, and he sent them to his sister and said, "Show these around the girls in your factory, and maybe they'd like to be pen pals, write letters, you see." And so we all got letters from these girls, and we wrote back to them. But the photographs he took, I have a habit, if I'm concentrating, I sit there with my mouth open like this, you see. And he'd taken a photograph of me sitting here like this. And the photographs must have looked really funny, you know. I don't know what these people thought, you know, of us when they saw these photographs.
You used to also talk to other bases, didn't you? They taught one guy, he taught another base to speak.
Yeah, this one here, Tony Feenan, he was really... he used to talk to that Argentinian base nearby, and they wanted to practice their English, so he would talk to the doctor and the base commander in English, and they would practice English. But he went through a phase of talking in old English, a bit like Samuel Pepys would have written, you know, really old English, and he would speak this over the radio to these Argentinians, and he'd teach them words that no one ever uses nowadays in English at all, and like Merry Andrew, or how droll, things, words that are not in common usage, he'd be teaching these Argentinians. So I hope they're not too cross with him.
And did you keep track of the news?
Apart
from football, probably.
Yeah, not very much, really. The only thing I remember is when the Americans walked on the moon, because our radio operator... he tried to tune the radio in, and I can remember him coming and waking us up and saying, "Look, they're walking on the moon, they're walking on the moon," but you could hardly hear anything. And so we didn't really keep in contact. When I was there, our radios were all Morse, you know, Morse code. There was no voice, so you couldn't hear anything. There was nothing you could tune in and listen to. So to get any news was so laborious that you just didn't bother, really. And so I can't remember... that we took any notice really at all of it. No. To be honest, the time just flashed by. I took books when I went down there. I took a great load of books. I said, "These are really good books. I'm going to take them and read them." Okay, and I brought a lot of them back. I never read after 2.5 years. You know, the time just seemed to go by so quickly.
What happened to your scientific work that you didn't finish?
Well, I wasn't doing any.
You went, but you weren't.
I was
doing
assisting.
Things like ringing birds and all that sort of
well
thing.
Then someone else carried them on.
They carried them on.
Yes, year after year it went on. Yeah.
I just read one line in the newsletters which said, "What's the use of breakfast when the sun ain't going up?" Sydney Island is not that far to the south.
No, it would be daylight by 9:10. And it will be going down about 2, you know, and there'll be light this either end of that as well. That was so we had a decent day even in the middle of winter. We would have a decent bit of daylight, and in summer it never got truly dark. So it was quite nice. You could walk out, you know, really late and still get around the island. But I was never conscious of, you know, the long. You know, people say that when it gets really dark all the day, you get depressed and this sort of thing. We never had any of that, you know, I don't think.
I mean, I don't know if it's come over to you, but certainly if you see some of his slides, people like Party Time was it on the hysterical side?
Oh, well, yes, yes.
You know, things like they would get in the water with one guy who went in the water,
yeah.
Didn't he?
Actually, we were... that is one thing we, that it wasn't, we were allowed alcohol. So that meant that people did, you know, all manner of things. You know, we were fortunate. There were no accidents, really, sometimes. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that we were totally irresponsible, but...
it was on the borderline, so yes. One guy went in the water, didn't he?
Oh, the one Christmas, they all decided to go swimming in the sea, so they all went in the sea at midnight. And the water, oh, is about 0 degrees, you know, and it's really, really cold. And, I mean, they just went in the shallow. They didn't go anywhere deep, just by the jetty. And then they came racing back in and
all got in
a bath. And I should think the big hobby that everyone did was take photographs, you know. I must have taken 2,000 slides, you know, and as many black and white pictures. And other people took, you know, more. And so, of course, if anything like that happened, someone going swimming with no clothes on, you take photographs. So they come and get in the bath. I've got photographs of about 6 people in a bath, you know, and you just took photographs of everything and you could develop them yourselves. We had our own dark room and you could develop colour pictures or black and white. And so that was a thing we discussed a lot, was photography. People did a lot.
And things like
that.
Photographs.
Mm-hmm. You have these photographs.
What, the colour?
6 people in a bath?
Somewhere, yes. I've got them somewhere.
No, I don't have to look at my own.
Okay, yes, I've got them. And what else?
And cake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the chef used to do you a nice birthday cake, okay? Well, the chef in the first year, he did a beautiful birthday cake for my birthday. But everyone had such a big meal that no one wants to eat it early on in the evening. So you have a party for your birthday and you provide the booze for your party. And towards about midnight, one of them said, oh, we've cut the cake, you see. And one of them said, would you like a photograph of your cake? You see, so he held it so I could take a photograph of it. And then he put it down. And it's one of these occasions when somebody does something and you think it's just perfect, and he put it down and he put his fist and he went smash right in the centre of this cake, and I've got a photograph of the sort of cake all sort of shooting out. And at the time it just seemed something I've always wanted to do, and there's someone who's actually put his fist in the cake. Anyway, we then had to quickly tidy the cake up so that the cook didn't, because he hadn't noticed, and then we tidied it up and cut it up quickly so that no one would notice.
But it was on the borderlines of hysterical, I think, yeah. Sometimes.
And we had one night when someone, he had too much to drink and he went off to the toilet, and he somehow ended up outside, and he got himself lost outside, and eventually we went looking for him, and we found him in on the edge of the beach with the waves coming up, and he was all soaked and all wet, you know. So if he'd stayed out there, that would, you know, you'd have died. But this sounds really awful when I say it to you now, but in fact, when it happened, it didn't seem as serious. It's only when you look back, you say, well, maybe that was a bad thing.
What was the average age of all of you?
I just think I was about average. I'd be, what, 21? 21. There's a few a little bit older, but not very many on our base. We were all about that sort of age, 21, 22. Jake, he was the oldest. He was out the Navy. So he'd been in his 30s. He was the radio operator. He was the oldest. Otherwise, all of us, he would have been a bit older. He'd have been about 24, 25. And we'd have all been, he might have been 24, 25. Then the rest of us would have all been about 21, 22, I think. And then in this lot, he would have been the oldest. He'd have been in his 20s. Rest of us, well, we were all in our 20s, but he might have been late 20s.
This is funny. Did you all grow beards over there?
Oh, yes.
The photos from the 40s didn't show that much beards.
Oh, I think we all wanted to grow a beard, you know.
This is a feature from the 60s.
Maybe. For me, it was just I wanted to grow one, and I don't grow a beard very easily. And in fact, it grows more on one side than the other. And it's ginger. My beard's ginger. But when you're down there, no one can see you. So, you know, you have a go.
When you came back, the people had started growing their hair long, hadn't they? A lot had changed when you came back. And you had an argument with your mother about whether somebody had long
hair. Yeah, it was really strange. My mother came to pick me up from the Southampton, where our boat came into Southampton. She came to pick me up and she drove me home. And it was the first time I'd really been in a car for... well, I've been in taxis in Montevideo, just on passing, but really apart from that, it's the first time I've been in a car for maybe 3 years, and I thought my mother was driving so fast, you know, it just, everything just flashed by. I remember saying to her, oh, we're in no rush, mother, we're in no rush, you see. And but anyway, what somebody drove in a funny way, did something wrong, and I said something about that. That girl wasn't, that was a woman driver. And she said, no, it isn't, it's a man. And when we got up, it was a man with long hair, and, you know, wasn't used to that.
At that time, they'd grown their hair long, hadn't
they? Yes, they'd, yes. And that, it was quite funny coming back. I had more trouble coming back, I'd say, than adapting when I came back, than adapting when going down there. You know, like, I remember going to a family wedding just after we got back, and all these people that I didn't really know very well, and you know, the sort of panic gets in you to be able to make polite conversation, you know, I can remember, and the sweat pouring off you, you know, and I can remember that, not feeling very good about it. But no, it was
meeting strange and foreign people.
Yeah. And
like that.
Yeah. I think if I had to summarise what were the things that I remember most vividly, I think one is the colour, because everything is really much more colourful than I imagined. Because I was brought up, I used to like reading polar exploration books, you know, Scott and Amundsen and things like that. But everything is much more colourful than I ever got the impression from those books, you know, the photographs in those books, everyone looks grey and gaunt and it's very white, and but the colours are tremendous, especially when the sun shines. See, you get if you get the sun can make the ice either look golden or red, depending where the sun is and in the sky, it can look the colour of the ice and the snow changes, or it can, the ice can look really blue and green, you know. So the colour is tremendous. And the way the wind shapes the snow into ridges and things, and the way the frost forms on things, that is really beautiful. And the ice on the mountains and glaciers, things like that, I think that sticks in my mind a lot. And I think the other big thing would be the animal life. It was tremendous, because most of it was unafraid of man, so you could get very close. There weren't many species, and not very many species, different species, but what there are, they're in vast numbers. So you see lots and lots of birds. I like that a lot. And the other thing is the people. You know, I think they were really, as I say, I found it very easy to get on with them. You know, maybe because we all wanted to be there, you know, and we all knew we were only there for a short time, so everyone made the most of it, you know. But I know my mother, she only told me recently, since you phoned up to, and I told her you were coming, when I said I was going to the Antarctic, I wanted to go to the Antarctic, she was really quite concerned. She thought it was not a good thing to do. So she phoned up a lady she knew whose son had done the same thing 10 years previously. He's called Peter Kimber. And she'd phoned up his, and she'd said to him, well, do you think he should go? You know, because they thought maybe this was just me doing something silly. And this one's mother said, oh, yes, she said, it made a man of Peter. You know, it built him up to go down there. But I know when I left, my mother was crying, and she said to my sister, she said, I'll never see him again, she said.
No, they lived down the road.
No, they lived down the road. But my dad took me to the train, and I went up to London, and then I caught a train from Waterloo down to Southampton. And it was the last transatlantic crossing of the Queen Elizabeth, the big QE Queen Elizabeth liner. It was the last time she was going to cross the Atlantic. So the train was full of people who were all dressed up, very posh people, all going to go on this last crossing of the Atlantic. And then I met Malky McRae. He was another person who was going to the Antarctic. I met him on the train. And I knew he must be going there, because he was the only one who was who had a big rucksack and skis. And so he was from Glasgow. And we got on board the ship, and we hung around then for the next couple of hours. And then eventually we saw the Queen Elizabeth go off down Southampton Water. And then we went out, and as soon as we got off, we went down into the fiddery, into the mess room, and we had a big pot of tea. And I remember that, and everyone relaxed a bit, you know, got to know each other. But it was good, it was really good fun.
Do you have any special memories of the sounds out there?
Sounds. Well, there's one sound that I remember was when you were diving under ice, if there was ice and you were diving, then there's no sound of the sea because there's no waves, okay? If you hold your breath so you're not breathing out, then there's no noise of your bubbles either. And then if there's a seal anywhere nearby, you hear this sort of whistling. It's a sort of almost like an electronic whistling sound goes round. But I never ever saw any seals underwater, but you get out of the water through your hole in the ice, and often within seconds a seal would pop its head up, have a look at you. Yet underwater you could have heard them, but you never saw them. It's that noise. Another noise was the penguins, because penguin rookery is really noisy, you know, constant noise. Another noise would be sometimes, like that island that we were on, a little island, okay, and there's a big island to the north of us, yeah, and that big island to the north of us had lots and lots of glaciers. And sometimes from our island, if there was an avalanche off one of those glaciers, that would make a tremendous noise, you know, and you'd hear this rumbling, a bit like thunder. And if an iceberg turned over, sometimes that would also make a noise like that. I think that's about the only noises I can remember. The other noise is the noise of the diesel generator, you know, that makes your electricity, because that's in the background 24 hours a day, you know, the throbbing away. And if you go off into the hills, say I'd go out on my jobs across the island, be complete silence because you'd be on your own, and then as you came home you'd come to the top of what we call the stone chute, which was the slope going down to the beach where our hut was, and then when you got up there you could hear the noise of the generators. It was like the noise of home then. Can't think of any other noises. I think that's about all I can think of, really. Yeah.